Vayishlach. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernovsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayishlach, as I already mentioned, but I have to say it again now. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, Tet Zayin Kislev, the 16th day of Kislev, 5770, on the secular calendar, December 3rd. A one-day belated happy birthday to my daughter Miri, and a week and a half welcome again to the world to my newest grandson, Elad Zamir. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tehiena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Imavonot tishmorya Adonai miya amod, ki imacha hasalicha lama'an tivare. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi, velidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael, mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya haomidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha hamakom yirachem alehem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora umishibud lgeula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. We'll get to Parshat Vayishlach in a couple of minutes. I first want to introduce a song from a sort of old Avraham Fried album called Ze Hazman. The track is called Vizakenu. I think I've played it or another version of it in the past. It comes from a Zmira of Friday night, one that I personally don't say, although with this song and another one, the words of which are both taken from this Ribon Kol HaOlamim, Master of All Worlds, which is printed, and I imagine said, between Shalom Aleichem and Eshet Chayil, even before you make Kiddush, which probably explains why I never got into it. It's a long passage, and before Kiddush, people are hungry. Zmirot, I find, work better during the meal, especially after the first course, so that hunger does not compete for the singing. Be that as it may, Ribon Kol HaOlamim has the following petition to God. Remember the situation. Friday night, came home from shul, having prayed already the evening service, preceded by Kabbalat Shabbat, the welcoming of Shabbat, and now you're about to sit down for your first Shabbat meal, the Friday night meal, and you've already sung Shalom Aleichem to welcome the Shabbat angels that accompany us, to say farewell to the weekday angels, and then is a long prayer with the following petition. V'zakenu l'kabel Shabbatot mitoch rov simcha. May we be worthy to receive the various Shabbats amidst great joy, umitoch osher v'chavod, and amidst wealth and honor, umitoch mi'ut avonot, and in an atmosphere of few sins. Then, a sentence later, we ask, V'tein banu yetzer tov, grant us a virtuous desire. La'avdecha, to serve you, be'emet, in truth, uvi'ir'ah, and in awe, uvi'ahava, and in love. We're beginning Shabbat. We might have had a hectic week, not too much time to do various spiritual kind of things, just about managed to daven, learnt a little Torah, some people more, some people less. But now it's Shabbat, and I look forward to a spiritual experience over Shabbat, time to study Parshat HaShavua, time to study other texts, time to share with my family. And I ask God that we should be privileged to accept Shabbat from great joy, not as a burden, God forbid, but with great joy, with wealth and honor, and with lack of sin. And please give us the natural inclination to serve you in truth, with yirah, reverence, awe, and maybe you could say most importantly, with love. What more could a Jew ask for? Avraham Fried, the album Zehazman, the track Vizakenu. Enjoy and feel it. Okay, let's get into Parshat HaShavua, Vayishlach, or Vayishlach as some people say it. Two seders ago, at the very end of Parshat Toledot, Yaakov, having previously acquired the birthright from Esav, and then receiving the blessing which Esav felt belonged to him, Esav plotted to kill Yaakov after Yitzchak, their father, died. Rivka, mother of both Yaakov and Esav, heard about this plot. Some commentaries say it was with divine intuition that she heard about it, since the Torah only says Esav said it in his heart that he was going to kill Yaakov. She tells Yitzchak, "I want Yaakov to go to my hometown, away from here, because I want him to find a suitable bride there and not from here." Yitzchak blesses Yaakov with the bracha of Avraham, which is the promise of the land of Israel, and sends him on his way. Vayetze, last week's Torah reading, was Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. Jacob left Be'er Sheva, following his mother's wishes to get away from Esav. Vayelech Charana, and he went to Charan, following his father's instructions to go there to find a suitable wife. The whole Parsha of Vayetze, Yaakov marries, first it's Leah, then it's Rachel, although it should have been Rachel in the first place. He has 11 of his 12 sons, a daughter, Dina, and after the birth of Yosef, Rachel's first, he takes his leave of Lavan. That brings him back to the land of Israel, first time in over 20 years, And at the beginning of this week's reading, we find that he is aware that his brother Esav is approaching with 400 apparently armed men. Yaakov is fearful of this encounter, perhaps overly so, and he knows it and he regrets it, that he's so fearful of it. He prepares his camp. He prepares gifts to appease Esav, and he prays to God. The gifts include many different kinds of animals. The message to Esav is, true, I have a lot of flocks and herds and servants, but I don't have that which our father blessed me with. So you really shouldn't be upset with me because the blessings have not been fulfilled. The blessings were for economic prosperity, which comes from produce of the ground, and I don't own any land. Then there was the moment at night when Yaakov was alone and he was attacked by the Ish, the person, the man. Our commentaries teach us that was the guardian angel of Esav attempting to kill Yaakov. Yaakov prevails, but is injured from the encounter. We'll talk a little bit about that later. And then comes the fateful morning where Yaakov and Esav finally meet face to face. Esav sees his long-lost brother, and he runs to him, and he embraces him, and he kisses him. Vayishakehu. When a scribe writes a Torah scroll, and he writes the word Vayishakehu, and he, Esav, kissed Yaakov, he writes a dot above each letter of the word. That would be the equivalent of what we might do to make something bold, to underline it, to double underline it, to overline it, to box it, to shade it, to put a big asterisk next to it, to call attention to it. And he kissed him. Commentaries ask, what's the point being made, or what's the inference being made, the implication? And Rashi, major commentary of the Torah, tells us of a dispute between some unknown, unnamed opinion and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The first opinion says, you know why it has dots over the word Vayishakehu? Because even though he kissed him, it wasn't sincere. It was for show. It was fake. And that's why the tradition is to call our attention to the word. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, true, it is well known and well established, and even a fact of life, unchangeable, that Esav sone liYaakov, that Esav, and I'll add, the Esavs of the world, hate Jacob and Israel, and to a different extent, the Jewish people. Afal pi, even though halacha hi biyadua, it is a well-known fact of Jewish existence that Esav hates Yaakov. At that moment of reunion, he was overwhelmed. Esav was overwhelmed by a feeling of brotherly compassion, and he kissed him with all his heart. This too makes it noteworthy, and I would say even more so than the first example, and we should get a little shiver up our spine at this picture of Esav, who generally hates Yaakov, nonetheless kissing him with all his heart, because of that momentary feeling of we are brothers. Allow me to point out what is probably obvious. This is not a two-sided machloket, a dispute, where the two opinions are equal and opposite. It doesn't say the kiss was sincere versus the kiss wasn't sincere. It qualifies the kiss being sincere with a fact which is unnecessary to mention on the first opinion. The kiss wasn't sincere because Esav hates Yaakov. Here, it's even though Esav hates Yaakov, this moment it was sincere. What always comes to my mind is Anwar Sadat, president of Egypt, who made the bold effort to come to Jerusalem to speak to the Jewish people and the people of the state of Israel, and he was rewarded by some fanatics in Egypt with his assassination. So the question at the time, and the question since has been, was Sadat sincere in his overture to Israel to make peace, or was he insincere? And can we apply the same learning as Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who says, yes, at that moment he was sincere. It was well known that Egypt hates Israel, and we can testify to that, that over the many, many years since the, quote, peace treaty, unquote, between Israel and Egypt was signed, we have not had casual, cordial relationship. It has always been tense, sometimes more so, sometimes less so, but always tense. And there's a reason for it. The reason is a natural enmity of Esav to Yaakov. We'll talk a little bit more about this. We have other things in the Sedra to touch upon, but we will take a quick break here for whatever Arut Sheva does during the between the two halves of the show. If you're listening to the two halves that are stitched together, there isn't any break. In any event, we'll be right back. Okay, we're back with Torah Tidbits Audio, and we've been talking, I guess, about what Rashi uses the words from a braita, halachahi biyadua. It is a halacha, a fact of life. She'esav sone le'Yaakov, that Esav hates Yaakov. Now, I want to carry this through the generations, not that I'm tracing family trees, or claiming this nation and that nation came from Esav. But, you know what? Let's start from an earlier time. Amalek. Amalek, arch enemies of the Jewish people, the first to attack unprovoked when we left Egypt. Amalek, the person, the progenitor of the nation of Amalek, is a grandson of Esav. And there's a midrash that says that Esav said to his grandson, I tried to vanquish Yaakov, and I was unsuccessful. I in charge you with the task of destroying Israel, destroying Yaakov and his descendants. And this is something that has carried through generation after generation, nation after nation, sometimes in a very obvious form, other times in a more subtle form, but we're talking about pogroms, and we're talking about persecutions, and mass executions, and blood libels. It's all there. We have a long, long history of being hated by the nations of the world. Do I mean to say that there is not one single non-Jew who doesn't hate the Jewish people? No, I'm not saying that. There are good non-Jews who have no hatred towards us. And here I'm going to mix Jewish people, Israel, because we consider ourselves to be one in the same. And if the world wants to claim, no, we're not anti-Semitic, we're only anti the political entity of the state of Israel, that's their discussion. From our perspective, from my perspective, anti-Semitism is one facet, anti-Israel is another facet of the same halacha hi biyadua she'esav sone liyakov. Again, I believe that there are always individuals who are the exception to the rule. I believe equally strongly that there is a rule that is in operation throughout Jewish history, including today, including the foreseeable future until Messianic times, which could be tomorrow, that the nations of the world hate Israel. The nations of the world hate the Jewish people. It's something that to deny is delusional and possibly suicidal. And I think that we have to behave with this kind, not of suspicion, with this kind of given fact, to be happy and surprised even, when individuals honestly act differently, but not to think that we are loved by other nations. Maybe there's even an exception to that. I don't want to get into that kind of argument. I believe very much that there are individuals who genuinely admire and love the Jewish people, and admire the state of Israel, and even love it, but it's not the way of the world. The way of the world, in its grossest form, is the rhetoric that we hear from Iran, and it goes all the way through and seeps through the words of various and sundry people who are leaders of their countries. You have, jumping from one to the other, but it's within the same idea, the so-called Palestinians, and I have to remember always to say the so-called Palestinians, because that concept is a myth. We are talking about Arabs who happen to live in this part of the Middle East. They're not a separate entity that was created to give them a leverage which they don't deserve. It's not warranted, and it's counterproductive for us. But the so-called Palestinians have never expressed on a grassroots basis a desire to live in peace and tranquility with Israel as their neighbor. Steps are taken towards a goal of coexistence, it is meant as a self-serving plan which ultimately includes the destruction of the people of Israel and the state of Israel. I don't mean to sound morbid, maybe I do, but it's a fact that we have to live with, and we could live very well with it if we only wouldn't fool ourselves. Need a little break? Let's take one. This is another track from Avraham Fried's Zehazman. The words come from the Shabbat morning Kedusha. Specifically the words, Ve'einenu tirena malchutecha, may our eyes see your kingdom, as it is said in the songs of your splendor, written by David, your righteous anointed one. Kadavar ha'amur b'shirei uzecha, al yedei David Mashiach tzidkecha. That's an introduction to the verse from Psalms, which is not part of the song. Yimloch Hashem li'olam Elohayach tzion, l'dor v'dor, hallelujah. God shall reign forever. He is your God, Zion, from generation to generation. Hallelujah. Let me end my comments on this, and I know that I did not do a thorough job, and I leave myself open to challenges and criticisms. I'm not making any definitive analysis of different peoples in this world, except what I said about Iran, but you could, and the Palestinians, the so-called Palestinians, but there's a lot more to be said. It's being said by other people, and I'll say my share. At different times, I want to leave this now with one other thought. In that whole dispute, in that whole discussion about the sincerity or lack of sincerity of the kiss, it does not say that Yaakov hates Esav. Yaakov does not hate Esav. We do not hate other nations in this world. We don't like people who are against us. But it is not a destructive hate that consumes those who practice it. And all it is meant, all of what my words were meant to say, was we have to be extra on guard with the realization that other nations, first of all, even in a benign way, always act in their own best interest. That's not a matter of whether they hate us or not. The United States, best friend that Israel has, acts primarily in its own best interest. If that best interest is good for us, we will benefit from it. If it is against us, or against part of us, or against what many people would like, then that's not good. But not because America hates Israel, because America and every other single country act first and foremost for their own best interests. Enough said for now. Let me abruptly change to a topic I said I would get back to, but let me give it an introduction. There are many mitzvot in the Torah that have no context, no story, no partner texts that help understand it, and there are mitzvot that are very much contextual. Example of a recent contextual mitzvah was Brit Milah, circumcision, in the context of Avraham Avinu's life and what he was commanded to do, and how this was a covenant between God and him as far as commitment to God and our symbolizing our commitment to God with the mitzvah of circumcision. It is a very contextual mitzvah. It has a more stand on its own venue in the Torah. Uvayom hashmini yimol bisar orlato. When a woman conceives a child and has a baby boy, she shall be tameah for 7 days, and on the eighth day he shall be circumcised. That is not a contextual mitzvah. But that's not where we count Brit Milah from. We count it from Parshat Lech Lecha in the context of what is going on. And it's very important. Coming up in Parshat Bo, you have the mitzvot related to Korban Pesach and to Matzah and to Chametz, all contextual. When you see it in the context of the story of the Exodus, it helps us understand it more. Sha'atnez, not wearing wool and linen garments wool and linen woven together, and everything else that's involved in Shatnez, not a contextual mitzvah. It's found in a list of mitzvot in Parshat Ki Teitze. It does not have a story that goes along with it. Doesn't mean it doesn't have reason, but it doesn't have a context. In this week's Parsha of Vayishlach, we have one mitzvah. It is only the third mitzvah in the book of Bereshit, the only prohibition in the entire book of Bereshit, and it is extremely contextual. It is the mitzvah prohibiting the eating of Gid Hanasheh. Gid Hanasheh is the sciatic nerve and the meat and fats in its vicinity, in the thigh of a cow, which is forbidden for us to eat. We are presented with it in such a contextual form that the commentaries have to assure us that this is a mitzvah from Sinai, not just a result from a story. It's like the opposite of other examples. Because the Torah tells us about the battle between the guardian angel of Esav and Yaakov Avinu, and that Yaakov was not vanquished, but when he ended this encounter, he was limping, he was injured, and the Torah says, therefore, the children of Israel do not eat the Gid Hanasheh. It almost sounds like a family decision. Let's remember the battle that our father Jacob had, and we will ban from our practice the eating of the Gid Hanasheh. Come the commentaries and say, no, this is part of Torah Misinai. This is as much part of the Torah as the prohibition of eating and drinking on Yom Kippur, and as the eating of Chametz on Pesach, and thou shalt not steal, and all other prohibitions of the Torah. There are 365 of them. One of them, from Sinai, is the prohibition of Gid Hanasheh. The context comes to teach us something, comes to remind us something, and therefore the mitzvah is presented not in the form of, and God spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel and tell them they may not eat the Gid Hanasheh, but it's put into the context of the wrestling match, the battle between Esav and Yaakov, symbolized by Yaakov the person, and the guardian angel of Esav, but representing the matzav, the situation throughout history, where our enemies have not been able to vanquish us, even though we leave the encounter occasionally limping, occasionally bleeding, occasionally counting our losses, but we are still here. And that is the point that the Torah is making, not in the command prohibiting the eating of Gid HaNasheh, but in the placement of the prohibition in the context of that story. There's a difference there. This would be a command without any attachment to a context. But it's not. It has a context, and the Torah emphasizes the context by teaching us this mitzvah in that story of Yaakov limping after his encounter. Just a practical side of Gid HaNasheh. The process of preparing an animal for us to be able to eat its meat begins with choosing only kosher animals and then applying halachic shechita, ritual slaughter, to render the animal dead. There's koshering, the removal of blood, major blood vessels, innervated blood through soaking and salting, and various other procedures, one of which is the removal of the Gid HaNasheh. Now, the easiest way to get rid of the Gid HaNasheh is to take the entire hind quarter of the cow and sell it as non-kosher and not worry about it for consumption, kosher consumption. That is considered removing the Gid HaNasheh, and it renders the rest of the animal's meat kosher. Or you can go through the very difficult process called nikur, or trabering in Yiddish, which is a complicated issue because of the various branching of the nerve and the blood vessels in the area, and it can be done. It is done in certain communities in Israel, in which case hind quarter cuts become available to the kosher market. The fact of the matter is, in the United States, it's not considered economically feasible to do it, and therefore you don't find hind quarter cuts. This might be a situation that has changed in the last 30 years that I've been out of active touch, 28 years out of active touch with what goes on in the States. But my understanding is that it is still an economically costly process, hiring specialized individuals who are trained in nikur, and it's just not worth it for the kosher meat market. It would raise the prices of those cuts tremendously, and it's just generally not done. In Israel, it is done. Not common. Meat of the hind quarters, regardless of the scrupulousness of the supervision, will not be designated mahadrin here, as far as I know, only kosher. And that's good enough for many people, and they will avail themselves of these cuts of meat. On a more mitzvah philosophical point, I wanted to make the following observation. Gid HaNasheh is by far not the only mitzvah that is contextual. It has some unique features, in that it's not mentioned anyplace else in the Torah. But aside from that, there are many examples where we have a context from which we can gain an insight into why God commanded this mitzvah. I don't have a problem, I don't think we have a problem, if someone says, you know why we're not allowed to eat the Gid HaNasheh? Because it reminds us of the perennial battle between Esav and Yaakov. That's definitely part of the story. It's not the prime reason we have that prohibition. The prime reason for any prohibition is God's command. Reason, first understand that we do mitzvot and avoid prohibitions because God said so? Do they make sense to me? Are they logic? Are they reasonable? Not relevant for that first level of commitment. I believe that the mitzvot are God-given, and I believe that He has His reasons for what He tells us to do and not to do. I might have overextended my welcome, in which case I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameach.